Hello, and welcome to One Stop Co-op Shop, your one stop for board game news and reviews. This week, game designers Peter Gusis and Michael Kelly will review a cooperative game and have a related design discussion. Hey, it's Peter, and I'm here with Mike.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the One Stop Co-op Shop podcast. Today, we're talking about Wormspan, and of course, focusing on the solo mode.
Yep, and at the end, we're going to talk about solo modes for co-op game or for competitive games and how they like replicate a player and how important is it for them to replicate a player.
Just like I'm going to replicate a host who could get through the intro.
Yeah, no, I mean, my voice cracked on the, hey, I'm Peter and here with Mike, too. So, yeah, this could be great. It's going to be great.
Peter's reaching that special time of his life, you know, when he has to watch videos in school about changes in his body and his voice. It's all very magical.
Changes.
Time to test this day. I don't know what the words are.
Bird and face is strange. Changes.
Is that what it is?
I think so. I don't know.
Anyway.
Not tell us if we're right, because David Bowie is not in the modern zeitgeist.
Yeah, I still love Bowie, but apparently not enough to know his lyrics. But yes, before, if any of you are still listening, after Peter and I sang, we want to thank some of our amazing Patreon supporters. If you don't know, we have a Patreon, patreon.com/onestop, where we have exclusive videos every month. At this point, depending on which tier you're at, you can get access to 60 extra videos. I think I counted the other day, which is pretty cool. Those are bonus playthroughs, top 10 lists. Peter and Jerry and I reacting to each other's top 20s. That was a recent one that we did that was pretty fun. So, yeah, and we also have early access to our videos and other stuff. So, big appreciation for our patrons keeping the show running. And this month or this week, I'd like to thank Stephen Wren, Dmitry Chernichenko, Jacques Lux, Trent Yakuk, and Patrick Lewis. So, Stephen, Dmitry, Jacques, Trent, and Patrick, thank you so much for your support. Thanks to everybody. And if Patreon is not in your budget at this moment, you can still help us out. You can subscribe to the YouTube channel, view some videos, leave some comments, or wherever you're listening to this podcast, leave a review. It all helps a lot to get more attention to the little co-op journey we're all on together.
And if you're listening to this when this podcast comes out, you may still have time to back or late back Flame and Fang on GameFound. I know we're up to like 990 some backers and we only printed 1,000 copies. So I do know, though, that not all of those backers backed for an actual copy of the game. So there are some available, maybe 50, but that's it for this first print run. So if you want it anytime soon, this is the time.
Jump on it, because we're trying to print them and ship them ASAP. It should.
Well, they're already printed, from what I understand. They were, last I had heard, they were waiting for the screen printed meeples, but I think that might even be done. So they may be packaging this week. So literally, that's what I'm saying. Like, if you hear this, the Game Found won't be going on for much longer. So back now or forever, wait until a second printing.
Yeah, hopefully we'll do it again. We'll see how things go, but yes. All right, so besides Flame and Fang, let's talk about a few things we've been playing recently. Peter, you said he had two, so what's your first one?
Well, so I have two, but most of them are teeing them up for you. The first one is a game that Jerry and I had been playing, and we talked about it on a previous podcast, but you attempted to play the solo mode of Dune War for Arrakis. Why don't you tell us how that went, Mike?
Yeah, it didn't... So, a little context, Dune for War for the Arrakis, War for Arrakis is a game by the War of the Ring designers. War of the Ring was in my top 20 games of all time on my recent list. Love War of the Ring, and I love Dune as an IP, especially the first, like, three books and the old movies and the new movies. So, I was very excited for this one. So, here's the bad thing. Here's what I'm saying. Maybe not the best way to do the game. I tried to learn all the competitive rules and all the solo rules. And the thing is, the solo rules have a lot of exceptions and changes to the competitive rules. So it was really tough to keep it all straight in my mind. And I was trying to play, and it was just a lot. The solo very frequently requires you, for whenever the Harkonnens, because you always play as the Atreides, following the Atreides and Fremen. The Automa always like requires you to count all these different strengths of things, and like whether their armies are strong enough, and if they aren't, then you got to find an army that is strong enough, and then that one's going to move, but you got to count spaces to figure out where they move. So I'm not saying it's a bad Automa system. I certainly didn't play it long enough to kind of internalize the processes, which would have of course made it go faster, because I play a lot of solo games that take a while. but it was just a little bit overly frustrating. Now, I will say, first impressions of the game, a lot of it is cool, but man, do I think Dune as a story is less interesting with this game system than War of the Ring.
Okay.
And specifically, I mean, like, story-wise, because Dune is one of my favorite books of all time. I've read that book like 3 or 4 times. I've seen the movies dozens of times. And I was like, if you don't know the War of the Ring system, and this is also in War for Arrakis, you've got like event cards. These are really powerful things. And they call to mind major events from the book. And in War of the Ring, it's stuff like, you know, Ride of the Rohirrim. I'm like, hell yeah, I know exactly what that is. That's awesome. You know, and then it's stuff like Wormtongue. It's like, oh, I hated that guy. You know, like all these really memorable, really interesting things. And then I'm looking through the cards for War for Arrakis, and it's like a vague quote I kind of remember reading somewhere in the book. Or it's like, Sardaukar, don't give up. And I'm like, all right, that's cool. I guess they don't. You know, then the effects are like, move some Sardaukar once. I'm like, okay. So it just, it is interesting. You know, The Lord of the Rings, you know, compared to Dune, is a very different type of story, and it's very episodic, and they travel through multiple places, and those places are very vibrantly described. Dune, again, one of my favorite books of all time, as is Lord of the Rings. Dune is not really about cool, interesting places. Like, you get some sieges, you get some, like, Gedi Prime stuff, there's a lot of sand. You know what I mean?
It's not only that, but it's also the memorable moments aren't battle related typically.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, Frank Herbert, the author of Dune, like, fast forwarded through a lot of battles. You know, like the ending battle, at least from what I remember, it's been a while since I've read it, but the ending battle where like Paul like and the Fremen like storm the central place and like attack the Emperor and stuff, most of that is like off screen, and they're just like there, and they're like, hey, what's up? We're here. We made it.
Right. Or they're one-on-one fights.
Right.
Rather than being like these epic moments where there's like battles like, you know, Helm's Deep or whatever else. So I do think that it suffers a little from that. But as far as gameplay goes, like I thought the gameplay didn't suffer.
No. And look, I'm very excited to play it competitively. And once I do, I think I'll be ready to try solo again, maybe. But yeah, I was planning to try. I'm traveling with my family for a vacation for a week in like 3 days. I was going to be like, I'll record this game. I've read the rule book through twice. It'll be great. I found some player aids online. Nope, that ain't happening. we're not recording War for Arrakis this week. Maybe another week.
All right. You said you had one, and then we'll go back to mine.
Yeah. So something Peter hasn't gotten to play yet, but I am loving it. Loving it. I did have a playthrough on the channel this past week as of the podcast going up. And, by next week, I will have my review. It's already recorded. I'm just going to post it next week. And that is Seventh Citadel, the follow-up to Seventh Continent. It's not even close. Agamonia and Seventh Citadel, I don't know what else is going to compete with them. I haven't played my copy of Primal yet, and I know I love Primal. There are other really good games coming, but Seventh Citadel and Agamonia, definitely my two games fighting for the number one slot this year. And there is no world where they won't be in my top 10 by the end of the year. You know what I mean? Like, there just aren't as many good games as are coming. There's no way in heck they will not both be in my top 10. Peter, I'm so excited to play Seven Citadel with you.
Really?
Dude, listen to this for a second. Okay, I'll be very quick, but because, you know, we'll probably do an episode on this. But imagine a game like Seventh Continent, but where some people say, hey, there's a fire to the east. Can you go check it out? And you travel east for a while and you find a fire. And then you can optionally like search around that very area, like just a few squares around that area. And then you go back and you report, and that's the end of the mission. You're done in an hour instead of, you know, just wandering around for hours on end, hoping you like stumble upon what's going on. And by the way, I love Seventh Continent. I'm talking to Peter here, who does not.
I do not. No.
And then imagine that you have a life counter that's kind of like your timer because you use it to get cards back. And then when you're running low on life, you just go back home, and maybe you didn't, you know, you fail forward, but maybe you didn't get a great success. Maybe you did really well for your mission, but you never have to eat, and you never have to like hunt for a while and grind and grind and grind just to survive. That all sounds pretty good, right?
Yeah, that sounds way better. So how would you compare it to something like Earthborn Rangers then, which is very episodic and mission based? And it sounds like similar, where you can just kind of stop whenever you want.
Yeah, so it does depend. So I actually tore through one campaign because I was loving the game so much because I wanted to like review a full campaign. Earlier scenarios are a bit more linear, even more so than Earthborn Rangers, because Earthborn Rangers lets you really wander around quite a bit. Yeah. Seventh Citadel does this thing where it's actually very much like Dune. There's all, both the games we're talking about have big giant worms that come out of the ground and eat you.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so they kind of gate your progress a little bit in that the things that are away from your mission will have like a higher level. So if you try to explore them, it'll take tons of energy. But if you wait until like the mission actually requires you to go in that range, suddenly you can go there for free or for a very low cost. Now, sometimes, like, it's, I don't want that to sound too negative because you can break that and there are things that are beyond those, like a little bit beyond those safe points. So it's not like you're always just following the obvious path. But yeah, so they kind of control it a bit. So I would say this is way less open world than Seventh Continent and way less open world than Earthborn Rangers, which again, a lot of the time, like, yeah, you kind of are like, I got to go somewhere over here, but you can like kind of flounce around for several days in between that, you know, and eventually get to it. This is way more directed than either of those, at least until there are like in the campaign I played, one of three campaigns in the game. Well, two plus there's an expansion. Later on, it got a lot more varied and like open world ended. And then the expansion campaign, just I haven't played it yet, but from reading like the stuff on the back about it, it seems to be like kind of the culmination where it says like you're going to go all around the world. But certainly the campaign that I played, it was cool. Like it's like, hey, go to the east. Now go to the south. Now go to the north. Hey, now go a little farther. And like, you know where things are. Maybe like push your bounds. So you kind of like learned the land in a very okay. like, not handhold. I mean, a little handholdy, but like not in a way that's insulting.
We've talked about this before. The benefits of something more linear is that you can tell a better story because you know where they're going to end up. Whereas if it's open world, yes, you can get to see cool stuff and experience new things, but it's really hard to tell a story if you don't know where they've been in the past and you don't know where they're going in the future.
Yeah.
So I think that there are definitely benefits, and I think some people are going to like a little bit of both. I think you and I have come down on the side of, hey, I'd rather it be a little bit more linear. That way I get a better story at the end of it.
Well, and like there's so few frustration points.
Yeah.
You don't really die. You know, you just have to run back home. I mean, I guess you could like push. I never pushed things so close to where I would die. You know what I mean? You level up really frequently. They have a whole like civilization thing, like a bit KDM-ish style that gives you really cool upgrades and stuff. The story is good. Like the things you're discovering and the some branching choices are really cool. But like all the exploration stuff in Seventh Continent is still there. The main like action mechanic, which I at least enjoyed, is still there. But it's just better. I don't know. Like it's not making me love Seventh Continent less. But certainly this one, if nothing changes about my main opinion on it, certainly this one is going to be higher ranked in like my top, if I ever do it again, top games list than Seventh Continent.
So real quick, because I know we're going a little long on this one. Do you think that it would be better multiplayer? Because that was one of the big complaints we both had about Seventh Continent is,
yes,
it's great for solo, but I don't know that I want to play it with more than one player.
Yeah, so I played some two-handed. I haven't gotten to play with you all yet. But yes, they do a similar thing to what Seventh Continent did, where you get a big discount for moving when you're like staying together. But there were some times where I was like, oh man, it would have really made sense for us to like split up here. That would have really like saved us some time and like helped us find some things. And then what's really cool, way better than Seventh Continent, in my opinion, is that right from the start, you create your character with like a few special cards, and they have this icon system that basically gives you four classes in the game. And yes, you can mix and match. And then whenever you level up, those cards like are kind of key to those classes too. So long story short, it seems, even from my little bit of playing with multiplayer, that in a like 2, 3, 4 player group, you'd probably have like some characters that are more focused on fighting and some characters are more focused on stealth. And you would kind of try to work together to get the right person in the right place for the right job. So okay. Yes, I think in many ways, it looks like it'll be better than Seventh Continent. And again, like my plays were 1 hour to 90 minutes to finish one chapter and the whole campaign's about 10. So it's also just like a Seventh Continent can just sprawl for hours and hours. You don't really get good checkpoints a lot of the time. This, I think you could easily like be like, hey, three buddies come together. We're going to play for an hour. We'll accomplish something major and really push the game forward every single time. It feels more like a scenario game that happens to be in an open world instead of an open world game, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And that sounds way better. And I'm super excited to try it because I like Agamonia a lot. But I think you guys even like it more than me because you're more story players than I am. Yeah. I do like the mechanics of Agamonia, though, a lot, too. So I'm still enjoying that one quite a bit. But I wouldn't mind taking a break to play Seventh Citadel because I am super curious about that. Although I may just borrow it from Jerry also and see if I can't get a game in. All right. So one more, and we'll make this real quick. It's a game I'm going to spoil a list from our Patreon list. It's our number 4 game of all time.
So you got to be a patron and watch the video for the ridiculous
to understand. But it is. Yeah. So according to our scoring system, our number 4 game of all time, which Mike had never played. And he still voted for it because I guess the other game was that bad, or maybe we had already. I don't know. Either way. But Nucleum. So, Mike, this was your first time playing. I've already glowed over this game. It is actually my number 4 game of all time. I just love the... So, it's similar to Brass, if you've ever played Brass. It's not a cooperative game. It's a competitive game. But basically, you're connecting different cities that you're building things in those cities, and you're trying to power them with coal and nuclear energy and things like that. But I just love the simple action mechanism of this and the way the economy works in this, so much cleaner in my mind, like once you get the basics of it. And I also like end game scoring conditions and mid game scoring conditions as you're going along. So all of those things combined to make it, to me at least, a much more streamlined, much more fun version of a system like Brass. But Mike, this was your first time playing. We did play competitive. There is a solo mode, but I think the solo mode's broken. Either that or I'm just really bad at the game, which might be true because I lost by almost 100 points. So, I mean, it very well could be that I'm just terrible.
Yeah, no, I thought it was really good. I would call it Power Grid meets Ticket to Ride meets some other Euros in a good way. I like all those games. I had a great time with it. On this first play, I don't really see it rising up to like challenge my top Euros. Great Western Trail, Ark Nova, and Lost Ruins of Arnak, I think, were like my highest ranked ones on my list. I don't necessarily see it getting that high, but I do really like the action system. You get like these action tiles and you're actually like buying them. So your action economy kind of changes throughout the game, but then you put those down to build like rail lines to connect things. So you're kind of taking away your own actions, but if you do it intelligently, you can get bonus actions and stuff. I think all of that is great. Yeah, it's like a streamlined game with really deep play, which I always appreciate. You know, like it feels like a lot when you're setting it up. Setup takes a while, but then once I actually like heard all the mechanics, I was like, oh, that's it. All right, I got this. So I'm totally down to play it again. I thought it was really good.
Yeah. And I mean, if you're planning on playing this, certainly set it up before everybody gets there. That would be my number one suggestion.
Don't be a Peter. Don't be a Peter.
Well, wait a minute. Don't be a Mike. Cause I asked you if you wanted to play it. You never gave me an answer. Then you showed up and you're like, let's play Nucleum. I'm like,
I said I wanted to, I don't know what I said.
Yeah. Well, we did set it up before Jerry got there, but yes, setup takes a minute and certainly setting it up in front of someone new is like, makes it even more daunting because like all the stuff you do during setup, you don't need to know it all when you're playing the game. Like it certainly gives it good variety from game to game, but it also, I think, is overwhelming to look at as you're actually setting things up.
Yeah. All right, cool. So yeah, so sorry that went a little bit long, but those are some of the things we've been playing.
I feel like this review is going to take 10 seconds. I'll be honest. There's literally 3 actions in the entire game.
I mean, I will say quite honestly, I am less excited to talk about Wormspan than I am about Seventh Citadel.
Yes. Well, and I guess you are saying that it is a worse game in your mind, but I'm not saying it's a worse game. I'm just saying it's a very simple, streamlined game that is not going to take long to go through.
I like Wormspan a lot. All right. So here, theme. It's Wingspan, but dragons. There you go.
Yes. You're collecting dragons.
You're like putting caves down and they're, slave dragons making resources for you. I'm not sure.
Yeah. No, I mean, you're exploring through the caves with dragons. I guess. Yeah. I don't know.
It's got a theme. It's got a theme. But yeah, for core mechanics, it's very similar to Wingspan, if you played that. It is a lot like a row engine builder in that you're getting these dragon cards, you're getting these cave cards, you put cave cards down in spaces on your board in these three rows, you place dragons upon them, they are often limited in which rows they can go into, and then you also are taking actions to activate the rows and like get bonuses from the dragons and the spaces in between when you filled them. So you're getting resources, you're getting victory points, you're playing more dragons for even more victory points, you're comboing them together. And then you also have like this guild board that's giving you these bonuses if you can rush fast enough to get to them. You have end of round goals that you get extra victory points for if you can like beat people out for them. This game also has a pretty solid solo mode, I'm sure we'll discuss. Yeah, I mean, anything major I missed, Peter?
No, because we're going to cover basically everything else about the game as we go through the review.
Exactly. Like I said,
there's literally three actions in the game. And so let's get to our top five.
Right.
So if it's your first time joining us, thank you. What we do here is cover our top five game. Not top five games. This is really one.
That's right. Every week. Top five games, baby. And it never changes.
Yes. Top five things we think you need to know about the game, starting with number five, which is the least important, going to our number one, which is the most important thing we think you need to know, but they're all important or we wouldn't list them at all. Although here, they might not all be important because I didn't have that many things to come up with.
Mine are all important, I think.
All right. So one of the actions you could do is my number five, and that's excavate. So what excavating is taking a cave card that you have in your hand. You will be getting them through actions we'll talk about later, I'm sure. But you'll be taking these cave cards and you will be putting it down on one of the spaces on the board. Every action you do in this game, we should say, costs a coin. You start with 6 coins each round. So excavate just costs you 1 coin to do. So basically, you're taking a cave card and you're putting it somewhere on your board, the leftmost space on one of those three rows. Later on, the caves will also cost you eggs to place. But yeah, that's basically it. But the thing that is interesting about this is what the cave cards do. A lot of them will give you the resources you need to be able to pay for your dragons and other things. They also may have cool actions in and of themselves. They may say activate a dragon you've already placed, or they may say draw another cave card and play it for free, or whatever. They have a lot of different neat actions, but a lot of what it does is build your economy and kind of accelerate your economy. It might let you draw dragon cards. It may let you play eggs. All of these things kind of, you know, get you victory points or give you cards and stuff to do later in the round. So I really like, because this to me, this wasn't in Wingspan, but this kind of replaces the resource tower that they had where you roll dice and then you could take one or two dice or whatever. That action, that's kind of replaced by the caves in a much more interesting way, in my mind, at least anyway. So that is my number five, which is the excavate action.
All right, so my number five is actually, well, no, I guess it's not really related. I was thinking of my next one. My number five, I just wanted to talk about it briefly, is the solo mode. And this is an Automa Factory, a Stonemaier-style solo mode. If you don't know what kind of their philosophy is, this game totally matches it. They try to find the intersection points and then streamline the rest. And I think this one is pretty admirable. It goes really quickly. They do interact on all the main like flex points. They clear out dragons that you might have wanted to buy. They race you for like the guild bonuses. They compete with you for the objectives. Now, it's also, and this was similar to the Wingspan solo mode and some of the other Stonemaier ones, it's pretty random. It can be pretty swingy. Like, based on which cards come out, they just get a whole extra action some rounds and don't get an extra action other rounds, which is fine. Like, I found the scores tend to still be somewhat similar, which is also potentially a knock against it. You don't really do anything that affects them. You pick a difficulty level, and they're going to get their points. And there's nothing wrong with that, because, again, they are interacting with you in the ways that matter. But at the same time, I sometimes felt like playing, I was like, why do I care which cards I'm giving them? They're just going to get 55 points anyway. You know what I mean? Like, it can kind of like feel like they just sort of reach a beat-your-own-score by the end. But again, I appreciate how they interact with you. It's on my mind specifically, like doing this review, because I just played the solo in Stone Spine Architects, which I don't think you've played yet, Peter. It's a really good game. It's a drafting game. And the solo mode, they do a cool thing with the drafting where basically the cards you don't draft go to the Automa in a certain way, but you see what their goals are and you see what they're scoring for. So you're constantly trying to be like, well, I don't really want this card, but I guess I should hate draft it for them because they're going to get like 10 points from it, even though this card would be better for my strategy. So it's just interesting to compare something like that to this. Like, I don't do anything to impact the AI. They just exist and they impact me. But that's also fine because then the game plays ultra fast and I just get to play fun Wormspan and they're over there doing what they're supposed to do so that I have to like pay attention sometimes. So I don't know. It's mostly a pro.
Yep. I'll talk about that a little bit later. My number four is actually, now that I talked about it in Nucleum, I probably should have put it higher, but it's the end of the round scoring objectives.
Yep.
I really like when games do this. It gives you not only a focus for this round. I mean, you look at my number one game of all time, Gaia Project. It's really, I mean, that's the main thing in Gaia Project as well. I love how you have like in that one, you have end game scoring and end round scorings. But this, it's like it gives you something to focus on for that round and compete over with the other players. And maybe you're like, yeah, you know what? I'm just not getting what I need to compete in this round. So you look down the line a little bit and say, okay, well, the last round's the highest scoring round, so maybe I focus on that instead of focusing on like this round specifically where I know I'm just not going to be in the competition. So I love when games do this, especially when they have as many different end of round and end of game scoring conditions as they do here, because otherwise, I mean, obviously you have some randomness in what caves come out, what dragons come out, but really what drives what you're doing, at least what I think about when I play the game, is these end of round scoring conditions and the competition you're going through. I really like how they do it. It's the same basically as they did in Wingspan, but I really do like when games do this. So that's my number four, the end of round scoring conditions.
Yeah, that's my number four too, although I combined it with the guild bonuses. And you're right, these are quite varied. You have a ton of these end of round goals. And I don't know, Peter, you already said this, but you see all four of them at the beginning of the game, and it has a market impact on what's valuable. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, this game, I really want dragons like this. I'm not going to play that dragon I played last game. Like, I really appreciate the diversity in play that comes from those, like Peter already mentioned. And then the guilds also, you got like four. And they're double-sided, so it's really like eight. And each time you get around this little guild board, which some of your like dragons and bonuses and caves will let you do, you get to place your cube on one of them. So, and the AI, if you're playing the solo mode, well, that's pretty random. They just kind of grab random ones. So that's not necessarily very smart. But yeah, you'll get like cool immediate bonuses. You'll get end game scoring. So the combination of these, like Peter said, really gives you something to go for, really changes up the feel game to game. I think it's great too. I love these kind of things in Euros. Like you'll see this a lot, I feel like, in Euro expansions. You know, it'll be like, hey, we added like little goals you're going for. And I want that in the game from the beginning. I love that in Euros. I think it's a really fun thing.
Now, you said there are four and they're double sided, and that is true. But the other side is for like, first side is for two and three players. The other side is for four and five players.
Oh, so you're right. I'm sorry.
They're basically the same. So there are four different guilds, but you're only using one per game. So it does vary it up, certainly. And I actually didn't include the guilds in mine. And I realized I'd forgotten that, but you'll see why in a minute. Because three of my spots were pretty well taken already, because my number three is another one of the three actions in the game. So we talked about excavating. The next one is going to be the entice action. Again, just costs you one coin to do, but it is what brings dragons onto your board. Now, you do have to have a cave spot there first. So those cave spots that you're excavating aren't just good for getting you resources, but they're also good because you need them to play dragons in that row. So each dragon requires its own cave spot, but you do get one on each of the three caves at the beginning of the game. So you do have a little bit of a head start. You don't have to put caves out right from the beginning of the game. But when you play dragons, the thing I think is interesting, and maybe it happened in Wingspan as the game got further along, but I felt like Wingspan was pretty muted with its abilities, where like every once in a while they'd have something cool, but a lot of them just gave you egg capacity and just gave you victory points. And I didn't feel like they did as much with the like placing cards under it or placing resource tokens on top of it. They did a little bit of it, but I actually felt even when they did do it, it was to some degree a little more complicated because it was like roll the dice and see what you get on those dice and do this and maybe you get a meat token and maybe you don't. Whereas here, for me, it's like much more thematic. It's like you have a dragon that likes to eat things, flip a card off the top of the deck. If it's small enough, it'll eat it. If not, then, you know, one way you bury it under, the other way you get a meat token, but like that you can use that meat resource later in the game. So like there are a lot of interesting effects on the dragons. And I think So this entice action, when you take it, they may get an effect now. They may get end of game scoring. So each of the dragons really has a very unique ability on them that I think really differentiates this game again from Wingspan itself. So
yeah,
that's my number three, the entice action.
I will say, I know Wingspan had some things like that where birds would like eat other birds and flip them and that kind of stuff. So I think like maybe more of these than you think, Peter, are straight from there. But
No. But I think it's the most interesting ones, right? I feel like every dragon has something interesting on it. Like
certainly the hatchlings that like grow up from like eggs to like full dragons. Those are, I think, new, and those are really fun. Yeah. So my number three pulls some of the stuff Peter already mentioned. I called it resource management, and this game has several resources. You've got cave cards. You've got dragon cards, you got eggs, you got food. I think that's all the main ones. And yep. I like how the game balances all those against each other. Maybe this is just me, but comparing this to Wingspan, comparing this to one I covered on the YouTube channel recently, Raising Robots, which is another very similar, like kind of row-based engine builder. I felt like in this one, I wasn't quite as tight on resources. In a good way. Like, I felt like I was more powerful and like I could play things consistently in a fun way. Cause some resource, like some engine builders really want to starve you for like a large portion of the game. And you only like at the very end, get a lot of things going. This game, I felt like, just at least in my experience, leaned a bit more into the fun. And like Peter mentioned, you got these cave cards that are often giving you resources. You got this guild track you're going around that's often giving you resources. So there's like a lot of fun ways to combo into getting the thing you need for the next thing and getting the thing you need for the next thing and getting the thing you need for the next thing. And I love those kind of things. Like Arnak does the same thing. And I would compare this a little bit to like the resource comboing of Lost Ruins of Arnak, where this gets you that, gets you that, gets you that. I think it's a lot of fun. Definitely enjoy it here in Wormspan.
Yeah, I will say that Linda got stuck on her first time playing the game.
Oh, no.
But I pointed out, hey, if you do the explore action on this cave, then you can draw a cave card, and then you could play the cave card, which will get your resources, which will let you play that drag. Like, and then you get that whole Arnak. Once she got it, because it was her first time playing it, and I, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, kind of open-handing it, we're both like, you know, just kind of going through it together, and it's like, yeah, you can combo and do those things, and it really turned out to be neat. But she did for 1 second like think she was stuck, and then it's like, well, wait a minute, you can get that cave card, which is the perfect thing you need for the rest of your combo. But I could imagine there would have been a situation where the cave cards weren't useful either, and like, then maybe she would have been a little bit stuck.
Or where you weren't a nice husband and let her know.
Well, again, it was a learning game. And I know she doesn't care as much about winning. Like, she just wants to have fun with all of her actions. Right. So if she had been stuck, I think it would have been more frustrating than it would have been. Again, it's not about the final score. It's about enjoying our time together. So, you know, that made it better for both of us because she didn't get frustrated.
Sure.
All right, so my number two is the third and final action in the game, which is the explore action. So the explore action not only costs you a coin, well, the first time you explore, it's going to cost you a coin in any one of the three. I mean, we keep calling them caves, but like the caves are also the cards you're putting down. So I'm not really sure. I think they're like three different caves, but yeah, it's weird that they're also called cave cards. So I don't know. But anyway, so you're exploring down one of these rows is basically what you're doing. We'll call it a cave for now. And when you do, you're going to get different things. As Mike said, depending on what row it is, you will either get cave cards, you'll get dragon cards, or you will get these resources that you use to pay for the dragon cards when you use the entice action. But once you put at least one dragon down, you're also going to get to that guild marker as well, which is going to move you around the guild board. And the guild board not only gives you resources, but it also does something unique. Each of these guild boards does something different, as Mike said earlier. And so getting around that track faster, so the more times you do this explore action, will get you more of those unique bonuses associated with the guild of that specific game that you're playing. So yeah, it's just, to me, this is kind of the main action that drives the rest of the game. It's and you can do each one. You could go down each row up to three times. The first time it just costs you a coin. The second time it's a coin and an egg. The third time it's a coin and two eggs. But the more and more dragons you play in that row, the cooler and cooler abilities you get as you go along as well, to the point where if you get dragons all across that row, at the end, you'll be able to use whatever that resource is to get you some kind of victory point earning thing at the end of the game. Where it, like the top row, I know when you go to the end of it, you can take up to two or three of the resource tokens you have gathered basically as you go down that row, and you can put it on different dragons, which will each be worth a point. On the bottom row, I know it's that's a cave row because those are the two I just went down.
Yeah, it becomes eggs. They put eggs on your dragons.
Yep, they turn into eggs. You discard up to two of them, and you could get up to four eggs doing that on your dragons. So yeah, it's just, and I guess in the middle one, you're probably tucking dragon cards under your dragons, if I had to guess, because you get dragon cards in that row. So I just like the fact that you get a special bonus also for completing the row. And any dragons in that row, if they have abilities that activate as your explorer goes by them, then those will also activate. So it's kind of fun to put together cool combos as this like explorer goes down the row. You're getting to activate all these different things, get resources, get it's like the gimme action. Like you get to do all this stuff and get all this stuff. So yeah, for me, it's the most exciting action that you take in the game, and that's the explorer action.
Nice. Yeah. So my next point kind of hits on a lot of those things, so I'll try to be somewhat quick. I called it action escalation and kind of the action economy in general. So this is one of those games, this is common in engine builders, where the first round is a lot quicker than the last round.
Yeah.
But I think this one does it in a nice, not too steep slope. So to contrast, Lost Ruins of Arnak, one of my favorite heroes of all time, the first round might take like 5 minutes, and the last round will take like 35, because you just do so many things and so many combos, which is amazing. But Worms Fan, I think, does it a bit more smoothly, because as Peter said, you have 6 coins. Now, yes, as you're placing your final caves, you can get extra coins, and then very few like cards, dragons, and things can get you extra coins. But generally speaking, you're only going to do like 6 or maybe 7 actions each round. But the actions get more epic. The rows of dragons get cooler. And besides that, besides kind of like that growth that's gradual but still fun and lets you feel like your engine has really improved, I also just like, and this is true in Wingspan too, the very tight action choices. You know, you don't get that many, and you can rarely do everything you need to do. It's like, oh man, I need a cave card. Crud, I'm going to put this down this dragon, but I got to get it before now or I won't win the objective. So I don't know. I appreciate the action system here. Turns tend to be pretty fast. Even at the end of the game, they aren't, in my experience, like super drawn out, although they are longer. But I think it does get that sense of growth and accomplishment that engine builders thrive on. Like, if you don't have that in an engine builder, what are you doing? Basically. Right. So I appreciate the action economy in this. I think it's fun.
Yeah, my number one was your number five, I think, which was the AI. And I figured since one-stop co-op shop, I'll end with the thing that that makes this available to discuss on this episode, which is the AI. And for me, it really strikes a very good balance. And I agree with you, though. It's funny you said your score is 55 at the end of every game. I think I had 66 on my last game against the AI. But I'm scoring like 107 points. So I'm not even sure. Now, I have not bumped up the difficulty to the level that I need to.
They do a good job of just basically making everything worth more points for them. And they win more. You know what I mean?
Right, right. But that's fine. Like, I just like, as you pointed out, they really hit every major interaction point. So some of the things that might be on the card. I mean, the card literally 90% of the time is just going to move them around that guild track. And it doesn't do what it normally does. They're just trying to get to those intersection points where they hit the guild, and then it says take a dragon card, or take a dragon card and a cave card, or take a dragon card and block up one of the spaces on the guild board. And that's literally all it does when it hits those guild spots. But that blocks you up a little bit. It takes dragons away from you. It may also clear the dragon row as well. So if you're like excited about getting a dragon, it makes you think about, should I get it now? The next card I flip up may actually clear the row. So that's another little bit of interaction. So it interacts in the market, interacts with the guild board. It interacts with the end of game scoring. It may say add a coin to the end of round scoring, and they'll have a base score, and they do something similar with Gaia Project where it's like, okay, this is what the AI is going to get, like, so you have to beat this. But in this situation, it's a little bit variable because it may say add a coin to it, which means add one to that number. Whatever that number was, it'll add one more. And so it may even say take a coin away. So that's one of the neat ways that they like interact with that as well. You're not actually sure, even when that last card is flipped over, whether it's going to be the same as what you thought it was going to be or not, or whether it's going to be a little higher or a little lower. So I just like that little bit of variability in there. So yeah, it's real simple. I mean, you literally flip over the card, move the thing a couple spaces, you might clear off a row and put a coin down, and that's literally all you're doing for the AI. So the AI turns are super fast, but it gives you the interaction that you need. As Mike pointed out, though, it does not let you interact with it, except the only place you interact with it is the end of round scoring stuff. Right. Like, you can super focus on certain things. You know exactly, or not exactly, like I said, it could be up or down a couple of points, but you know about where they're going to be at the end of the round. So you could really focus on trying to beat them out at those certain things. But I just liked how simple and quick it was and let you get back to your turn. I actually think it's not a bad way to learn the game, honestly.
Yeah, no. Yeah, especially compared to something like War for Arrakis. I agree.
Yeah.
I played Wormspan. I think I might have played it solo before I taught my kids and my wife, you know?
Yeah.
And I think it's great, too. I hope my number 5 point didn't sound negative. I do think it is. Here's the thing. Wormspan is not that competitive of a game. Like, you don't have that much direct interaction. So they didn't add much. You know what I mean? But that's okay.
Correct.
It's not like I can totally destroy Peter's board in the game anyway. I can't like send Dragonfire down upon his combos. Cool. My number one is something Peter already mentioned. It is specifically the dragon card combos and the, what was it again? Explore? Visit?
Whatever that action. Explore. Yep.
Explore. Yeah, yeah. It's just fun. It's varied. I love when I like have this dragon and he does something that lets this dragon score something that lets this dragon do that. You know, I talked about this a bit with the actions themselves and how like your first action will get the stuff you need for your second action, will get the stuff you need for your third action. But the dragon combos and the variety in the dragons distills that to a single action by the end of the game, giving you like tons of cool stuff. Like Peter said, I appreciate that the like end of row things. I have not played Wingspan in a while. I feel like I was filling my board in Wormspan more, maybe by design. That kind of goes into that whole feeling of like I just had more stuff in Wormspan than Wingspan. Do you find that you generally fill your board fully, Peter? Like you get all 12 dragons down or whatever it is?
Last game, I got 10 down.
Okay.
So, I mean, I feel like I get close, but I agree. I feel like it's more than in Wingspan. And in Wingspan, it took more actions to do it. I'm not exactly sure why. Maybe.
Well, you needed tons of... Well, I guess you need eggs. I don't know why Wormspan. I got to play Wingspan again to like compare. But anyway, I like the combos. I like the things you build with your dragons. The dragons are cute. They include like a little book of like fake dragon facts they made up. I did a like little fake nature documentary voice in my playthrough on the channel of it. Just like talking through each of those. Whenever I played a dragon, I'd be like, oh, and here's the spined fibfish. And he likes to eat baby mongooses, you know, like whatever. I don't know. It's just
right, right.
Yeah. So I guess I'll jump into final thoughts. I really like this one a lot. I liked Wingspan okay. I say unabashedly, this one is far preferable to my taste. Now, it could have been the exact same game and just dragons, and I probably would have already liked it better because I like dragons more than birds. Sorry, birds. But I do think the guild board, like Peter said, I do think there's more varied powers for the dragons because they're kind of let loose a little bit in that respect. I think you get more stuff. I think it's a little bit like slightly more forgiving to the players. I think the combos are a bit more powerful. I find it better in almost every way. And even taking Wingspan away, I think this is a really solid engine builder. It's not going to be top 50 for me, like something like Ark Nova, but
right.
I ain't playing Ark Nova in like 30 minutes solo. I'm not playing Ark Nova with my
right.
family in 45 minutes. I'm not playing Ark Nova with my 8-year-old or my 11-year-old at all. Like, this is a much more accessible, quick, fun game. The solo mode is lightning fast. So yeah, I think it's a really good one. I'm very impressed. Stonemaier, it's been like Expeditions, Apiary, Wormspan. That is a solid, like I don't always love Stonemaier stuff. That is a solid 1-2-3 punch of game releases for them recently.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree. I think they've always done a good job. And obviously, like, things like Viticulture are top on some people's lists. They've never been top on my list. Even Scythe, which I'm more interested in than I am enjoy playing for whatever reason. But these latest games, yeah, I mean, maybe it's they're just more Euro and they're less like trying to figure everything out, or maybe it's just more streamlined. And I agree with you on Wingspan. I liked Wingspan fine. It never excited me to play it. I actually have really been excited and really enjoyed every time I played this. And I do think it is that Lost Ruins of Arnak, like, get this, to do that. I don't feel like Wingspan had that as much. And again, I haven't played all the latest expansions, all the latest birds. Maybe it's like the exact same game now as what Wormspan
is. Yeah, I have played all the latest expansions and covered them. And I think it's gotten better with the expansions. But no, I still think Wormspan's better for me.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this one. And like Mike said, I think it's a good game. You know, if you can get people to play a game about dragons, right? Like, I do think that's a advantage maybe that Wingspan has, is getting non-gamers, because these aren't the heaviest games in the world. And I do think they'd be accessible to a lot of people. So even though I do like dragons better myself, I think Wingspan may be a better theme to get more people into the gameplay. But I mean, certainly for me, the dragons made it better. And I do like the actions and the mechanisms better in this one. Although, let's be honest, they're very similar.
Yeah.
So, but that's it. So Wormspan, we both really liked it. And I think it's really good. If you want a shorter engine builder game, I really think there's not many that are going to beat this one.
Yeah. And I want to give a quick shout out, because I just remembered this. Connie Vogelman is the designer of Apiary, and yep, it's also the designer credited for Wormspan. Now, clearly Wormspan is a very different thing. Apiary is a pretty original design. Wormspan, yes, is very heavily building on the, you know, Wingspan formula, but still I am loving, like, Jamie Stegmaier did a good job getting Cogni on the team, because she is rocking it with her last, you know, Apiary was her first release design ever, I believe. So she is great. And I think she's local. She's out of D.C., Connie Vogelman. So that's cool.
Oh, nice. Well, so is Elizabeth Hargrove.
Yeah, that's right. Sorry, I knew. I'm guessing they know each other, probably. I'm sure they've worked together, especially for Worm.
Right, exactly. Cool. All right. Well, so that is our review of Wormspan. Let's talk about AI and what they really need to do, at least in our opinion, and different ones we've encountered and what we like and what we don't like. So, Mike, you've played a lot more solo stuff than I have. What are you, where do you want to start this discussion?
Yeah, so first of all, we kind of already talked about this a bit with my number 5 point and Peter's number one. And I know we've done podcasts on this before, so I'm sorry if we're repetitive. But hey, it's good to revisit things sometimes and kind of see if our thoughts have changed. But there are some, like, sliding scales here. To what extent does it replicate a real player? That's a big one. To what extent does it replicate the interaction points between player and other player? And one that I'll add that I don't think we talked about last time we talked about this, but again, goes to something like Stonespine Architects. Does it, or is it possible for it to add more interaction points and more thinky things than actually exists in the competitive game sometimes?
Sure.
You know, I don't think you should be doing all those things at once. And I'll lead with my biggest advice before we get into the nitty gritty, which is it is so dependent on your game and what you're trying to replicate. And by the way, we're talking about just about solo modes and not something like, you know, like an entirely different mode where the game suddenly becomes like a cooperative boss battle. Like if you're playing Wormspan, but you're using your dragons to like fight against like Viking ships that are invading your land. That's not what we're talking about here.
Trying to replicate, and I would say mostly in Euro games as well, because I don't think, like, you're not going to have a dungeon crawl. Like, solo mode is literally just take one character usually. Like, it's not like changing the whole game dramatically. This is like what was meant to be a competitive game. How would you replicate a player basically with some kind of an automa?
Yeah. So just to get a little bit more nitty and gritty, that should be, Peter, that should be our new nickname. I'm Nitty and you're Gritty, okay?
Oh, I'll be Gritty.
Yeah, maybe. Peter's so gritty. Something I've thought about recently is, because I'm often, when I design solo modes, and, you know, although I haven't had as much time recently, I do like doing that. I usually lean toward, I want it to be as similar to a real player as possible. But looking at the games I've designed solo modes for that did that, they are games that have very nuanced interaction between the players all the time. And if you didn't have that, like, replication of player, it wouldn't really work. So as a quick example, in my solo mode for Exceed, which is a card-based fighting game, and you each have, like, a hand of cards, and you're attacking with them and stuff, I could see somebody's solo mode, actually, I think I've seen this online, not having the enemy have a deck of cards or a hand of cards, you know, and they just, like, do things a lot more, like, randomly and such. But I think when a lot of your interaction points, like in a game like Exceed, relate to resources the enemies have, I think something is lost when the resources are cut. You know what I mean?
Sure. Yeah.
Or like another example we might have talked about this last time is in the coin system, these big like war games with multiple asymmetric factions. Some of the automa that they have, the official ones, cut the resources they spend for actions. And it just feels weird when they can do actions for forever as though they have infinite wealth when a player could never do any of the things. And I'm like, these are highly interactive games and the opponent is not playing like a player ever could anymore. It's like when you play like a video game like StarCraft.
I was just thinking that.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and like, wait, what do you mean that you built three bases already? That's literally not possible. You know, they accelerated all your stuff and gave you a ton. Or the old Civ games. Remember how like in the Civ games at the higher difficulty levels, the enemy Civs would just be like, and like immediately expand in ways.
I actually don't mind that. Because the other way, at least in video game, I'm thinking back to video game examples, like did it bother me back then? And it didn't, because I think the other way they could have gone, and maybe they couldn't back then because of technology, is making the AI just way better than you, right? Anticipating your moves, moving quicker. And I think I would have been much more frustrated than going up against this overwhelming force and it's like, oh my gosh, and I'm beating it with skill. And again, I'm relating it back to the board game thing as well. I don't mind them getting some overwhelming force and doing things that players can't do because it makes me think in a different way. Maybe I wouldn't be able to, you know, how do I take down this big thing that no player would have early? But it makes me think differently, I guess. And I actually don't mind it for another reason. Now, look, don't get me wrong. I love what Wormspan did because I do think it prepares you to play the game. But I also don't mind it if the solo mode goes a little bit astray because that way you don't just get really good at the game. And then when you play with your friends, now you're just like 50 times better than everybody else that you're playing with. And it's like, okay, well, this is not fun for anybody else. It's almost like somebody that goes off and practices games on their own. And look, some people like to do that. And like, and I think there's room for both, right? I think something like Wormspan will get you much better if you're ready, trying to prepare for a tournament or something like that. Because again, you can get games done really quickly and like practice what you're doing and putting your engine together. And it does, you know, do some of those interaction points where it's going to like compete with you. So I think both are good. But what I wouldn't want it to do is almost like some of these AIs now that we have on online board games where they're just better than me, right? Like through the ages, like I'm just like, okay, the expert AI is literally just better at the game than I am, which doesn't make me feel good. I'd rather them just cheat and get like a lot of stuff.
Yeah, because then when you lose horribly, you'd be like, well, they just cheated. That's
not right, exactly. Yeah.
So I do want to, what you said is 100% true. I should clarify that what really is annoying in a solo mode, and you don't see this a lot of times, it depends on the type of game, is when your tools and interaction points don't work anymore. Sure. So in Wormspan, I can't screw Peter over anyway. I can't steal his resources, generally speaking. And, you know, if I can, very rarely, I can just get them from the supply, whatever. So the fact that the game and the automa is not accurately modeling exactly how much meat they have and whether they can actually play that dragon, I don't need them to, because who gives a crap? I can't do anything about it anyway. But, you know, going back to like Exceed, like a head-to-head fighting game, if I didn't model the enemy having a hand and then like my character's power is if you hit them with this awesome attack, they discard their entire hand and it's like, oh, so it does nothing because that doesn't exist right for them. And my coolest tool just became like a nothing tool. And you see that a lot in these solo modes, like especially when you have this happens sometimes when you have a good Euro that has really strong interaction. And sorry, the way I just said that makes it sound like good Euros need to have a lot of direct player confect, which I don't believe. I think you can have a great Euro where you're just kind of building your own thing and your farm looks great and so does theirs and yay. But when a Euro does have really strong player interaction, and then I like read the solo mode, it's like, beat your own score. I'm like, what are you doing to me? You know, like,
yeah. Feast for Odin was one of the worst.
Oh my gosh. Like, yeah, that game has a lot of like direct grabbing things people want. And like, yeah.
Well, before they do it, but the way it worked for solo in that game is you literally played two players. So like turn one, you used yellow cubes, turn two, you used red cubes, and you just block your own spaces, like, and go back and forth. So you could literally play it the exact same every time you played. And that game already, in my mind, the biggest flaw for that game, and the reason it didn't make my top 20 games, is it doesn't have enough variation from game to game. I still enjoy it every time I play it, but that's because I play it every 1 to 2 years. I feel like if I played it like 5 times in a row, I'd be like, oh yeah, this is what I do every time when I play. There aren't enough pain points in that one, and the solo mode just made it worse for me. But getting back to what you're saying, there are actually some games I could think of also that are very interactive, like Keyforge and Keyforge Adventures. Like you're saying, some of the cooler actions you do in that game aren't really replicatable. And so some decks are built around like really weird, janky systems, and like they just don't work against the AI.
Whereas a different one, I know we have played this a while ago, so you might not remember, but I think, by the way, I'm not saying which game is better, but I think Ashes Reborn compared to Keyforge did a way better job with their solo co-op mode, because I think, I forget what it is, I think out of like the hundreds and hundreds of Ashes Reborn cards, like 2 don't function for solo co-op mode. For Keyforge, it's depending on what scenario you're playing, it's like 30%, you know, like don't do something
you're supposed to. It's much more combat focused, most of the scenarios, than the game of Keyforge actually is. So it actually tries to turn Keyforge, which might have decks that aren't very combat focused at all, into a purely combat game, which means, and especially the way Keyforge works, where you just buy a deck and you play with it over and over, it means some decks just don't really work for some scenarios.
Well, I'm sure that's all in their business plan.
Yes. But there was another game that did Lost Ruins, or not Lost Ruins, Eldervale. I don't know if you remember that one.
I never played it solo. I played it competitively.
Yeah, well, so the way it worked, and it made me think, because you said something where it makes you think in different ways sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
So Eldervale, the way it worked is, and again, this is a kind of area control game where you're like fighting over spaces on the board, but you turn your people into like huts, which would kind of help control spaces, and then they were kind of hard to remove at that point. But so there was some interaction, there was some fighting, but the interesting thing about the way they did it is they basically had 3 cards that were face up for the AI. And you would roll a dice, and like 1 through 3 meant you did card 1. 4 and 5 meant you did card 2. 6 meant you did the last card.
I think I first saw that used in several David Turksy, Nick Shaw solo mode collaborations. I'm guessing Turksy probably also did the Dwelling of Eldervale solo mode. So they've used that, and he's used that in tons of games. And I think it's a good one. I think it's good. Like you said, you... Well, I'm sorry. You didn't actually finish saying. Go ahead and say, and then I'll...
Yeah, I was getting there.
I know where you're going.
But basically, it makes you play the probabilities, right? And you go, oh, okay, I know they're going to move left here. So maybe I move all my stuff to the right and like get out of their way because they're going to have overwhelming forces on me. And there's no way I'm going to win if they do that. And then, of course, they roll something else and it doesn't matter. Or there's no way they can move up this turn or whatever. I mean, there's a lot of movement affected by the game, and actually to some degree it annoyed me because sometimes I would just like get stuck in a corner or whatever else, and I just knew they couldn't do anything to hurt me that turn, but it would certainly affect how I played, and I would do things differently based on what I knew the possibilities for the AI were, whereas if I was playing with a person, there's 0% chance I could know that like they weren't going to go to this space next turn, and so it wasn't like there were no safe spaces for you.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And that does go to like kind of this third thing I wanted to address, which is the idea of like the solo mode challenging you in new ways or adding new thought processes to the play. And I think what both your example, Dwellings of Eldervale, and kind of that Turksy 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, like 3 card activation system he uses a lot does And that also, the example I mentioned, Stone Spine Architects, where everything you don't draft goes to them. I think both of those give you more information than you have in the competitive game, and more predictability or control than you have in the competitive game, while also facing an opponent that is in many ways stronger than you or does more than you can ever do. And I think that's a cool thing to do. Now, I can see a pitfall in talking about it, not necessarily for Elder Veil or
stuff. Oh, it didn't work in Elder Veil at all for me. I know some people really love it, but I did not enjoy it at all, because I did find that it was easy to kite around or ignore or whatever. Like, I found it not interesting because of that, honestly.
Yeah, so I was going to say, I think that system, when I've seen it, like in some of Turksy's solo modes, for example, I think it works best for me when it's, first of all, a simpler game, because I do like some brain burn in solo, but I think you can push your audience away if the game's already like a pretty complex game. And then on top of that, you're adding a whole bunch of 50 other things to think about, because the solo mode gives you more information. You need to be careful with any of these kind of systems that the AI can't get trapped, that you have kind of an oh crud lever that like moves them out. Because yeah, when you break an AI, I guess there's a little bit of fun in that for like a moment. It's kind of like when you break your game and it's like, whoops, I clipped through the floor in Grand Theft Auto or something, but then you're just in the floor and you can't really play the game anymore. It's not much fun anymore. And I've broken solo modes before. Actually, some of Turksy's solo modes, I've like sent them things and they've changed it for the next printing. I remember that happened with Pro Scion 3, one of theirs. And yeah, like, I don't know. You don't want that, because you want to have a fun challenge. You don't want to break it and then the game doesn't work. Or what sucks for me, and this was like what it was in Pro Scion 3, is if you find an exploit that makes the AI too dumb to win, then you have to be like, well, I guess I won't use that. Like, I guess I won't use the winning strategy. And that's just a weird psychological headspace to be in, you know, like handicapping yourself because they miss some, you know, interaction that is really powerful or something.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess we'll just wrap it up with the, like, my favorite kind of AI is the AI that does a little something. I mean, very similar to Worms. Wormspan is probably near the top, and that's why it was my number one instead of number five. It is near my top of AIs because it does just enough, right? It's like, I think Ark Nova's AI was a little too little. Like, it didn't really do a whole lot. There was no AI, actually. It was just literally a timer. And the timer got faster and faster as the game went on, so you got more and more money, which doesn't happen in the real game. So I don't know. It was just...
It teaches it you like to play the game badly by changing all the rules.
Well, and again, it's good, I guess, in a way that, like, you're not getting better at the game, as we said earlier. Yeah, so that one was a little weird to me. But no, I think Wormspan does it in just the way I want it to, which is you flip over a card, you do something very little that takes no time at all, and you get back to doing your fun thing. Gaia Project, my number one solo game of all time, does this as well. Marvel Champions breaks it a little bit because sometimes they do like do this card, which triggers this card and does this other thing. But it's always just literally like flipping a card. So a lot of times I don't mind it because it's one little thing at a time. But the turns can get the AI turns get a little longer than what I want them to be sometimes. Whereas Gaia Project and Wormspan, I think, do a much better job of keeping the AI turns pretty simple, but also doing things you want. Meaning interact with you in certain ways that are interesting interactions in the game and get out of the way quickly.
Yeah, and I might, you know, this is, I think, true of last time we talked about this. I might lean more towards AI that more closely replicate a real player. But that's also because some of my favorite solo modes are for some of my favorite super asymmetric competitive games that I just want to be able to play more often. You know what I mean?
Sure.
So like, you know, Root, Exceed, Tyrants of the Underdark, you know, games that I like the solo mode for, that I designed a solo mode for. Like, those are games that are super in-your-face, kill-each-other kind of games, and I just wanted to play them solo more, you know?
Now, wait, did you design the solo modes for all those except for Root?
Yeah, except for Root, yes. I did what I believe is the most
popular. You're like, I like my solo modes better
than... No. I'm trying to give an example, but no, Well, I don't know. I don't feel like there are as many solo modes that I'm talking about. Yeah, because the thing is, when I play, I've said this many times. I don't generally keep Euros unless my family wants to play them. I don't generally play Euro solo modes unless I'm covering them for the channel. It is not what I will grab off the shelf, but I really like Euros competitively. You know, I had a great time playing Nucleum with y'all. I played Stone Spine Architects with a bunch of people. And again, the drafting game. I'm really liking that one, by the way. That's why I'm mentioning it a lot. I played that today, and that was great. Like, I like competitive Euros. Solo Euros, I don't know. There's so many amazing, like, adventure games that are solo, and I just would usually rather play those. That's just my taste. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. Some thoughts on solo modes from both of us. Hope it's helpful to people out there. It just, like, makes you think. Feel free to send us an email. Let us know what some of your favorite solo modes are. And I guess that's about it. I'm going to be in Puerto Rico in a few days. Woo! Peter, you're traveling too, right?
Yeah, we're going to head down to the Carolinas, which I know is where you go a lot of times on your vacation. So,
and this time we are not going to my wife's family. Well, actually, no, never mind. My wife's family also lives in Puerto Rico, and we're like hanging out with their cousins for most of the time. So still my wife's family, just different wife's family.
Well, and I'm going to hang out with my wife's family. That's why we're headed down there. So now all the in-laws are down there. So maybe you and I can sneak off sometime when the wives go down to visit the in-laws.
Oh, we should totally coordinate. That'd be awesome. It'd be like, oh, man. Peter.
Yeah, we should totally do spring break with your family again this year. Where's the game store in North Carolina?
Yeah, actually, I met, and Steve's down there too, and Derek from Kanji Studios. I met Steve at a game store in the Carolinas, and it was great. So, yeah.
Yeah, we'll definitely have to plan that in the future. I don't think I'm getting away with it this time. That's why I have not reached out to anybody, but this is our first time down there since her family's moved, so that's not going to happen. But anyway, that is neither here nor there, and that all that's getting cut. So, I will talk to you soon. Bye!
Thanks for joining us again for the One Stop Co-op Shop podcast. Check out our YouTube channel at One Stop Co-op Shop. Also, join us for games and discussion on our Discord channel. You can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/onestop. Or leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks again, and we'll see you next week for another top 5 list.
Hey, Nitty.
What's up, Gritty?
Have you ever seen anybody do the Gritty?
No.
Is that what that dance is called? It's called the Gritty, right?
I don't know. I've never heard of a dance called the Gritty.
I mean, I'm cooler and hipper than you, apparently.
That's always true.